Chapter 9. Dr. Bauerstein. I had had no opportunity as yet of passing on Poirot's message to Lawrence. But now, as I strolled out on the lawn, still nursing a grudge against my friend's high-handedness, I saw Lawrence on the croquet lawn, aimlessly knocking a couple of very ancient balls about with a still more ancient mallet. It struck me that it would be a good opportunity to deliver my message. Otherwise, Poirot himself might relieve me of it. It was true that I did not quite gather its purport, but I flattered myself that by Lawrence's reply, and perhaps a little skilful cross-examination on my part, I should soon perceive its significance. Accordingly, I accosted him. "I've been looking for you," I remarked untruthfully. "Have you?" "Yes. The truth is, I've got a message for you, from Poirot."
"Yes?"
"He told me to wait until I was alone with you," I said, dropping my voice significantly, and watching him intently out of the corner of my eye. I have always been rather good at what is called, I believe, creating an atmosphere.
"Well?"
There was no change of expression in the dark, melancholic face. Had he any idea of what I was about to say? "This is the message." I dropped my voice still lower. "Find the extra coffee cup, and you can rest in peace." "What on earth does he mean?" Lawrence stared at me in quite an affected astonishment. "Don't you know?"
"Not in the least. Do you?"
I was compelled to shake my head.
"What extra coffee cup?"
"I don't know." "He'd better ask Dorcas or one of the maids if he wants to know about coffee cups. It's their business, not mine. I don't know anything about the coffee cups, except that we've got some that are never used, which are a perfect dream. Old Worcester. You are not a connoisseur, are you, Hastings?" I shook my head. "You miss a lot. A really perfect bit of old china. It's pure delight to handle it, or even to look at it." "Well, what am I to tell Poirot?"
"Tell him I don't know what he's talking about. It's double Dutch to me."
"All right." I was moving off towards the house again, when he suddenly called me back. "I say, what was the end of that message? Say it over again, will you?"
"Find the extra coffee cup, and you can rest in peace."
"Are you sure you don't know what it means?" I asked him earnestly. He shook his head. "No," he said musingly, "I don't. I wish I did." The boom of the gong sounded from the house, and we went in together. Poirot had been asked by John to remain to lunch, and was already seated at the table. By tacit consent, all mention of the tragedy was barred. We conversed on the war and other outside topics. But after the cheese and biscuits had been handed round, and Dorcas had left the room, Poirot suddenly leant forward to Mrs. Cavendish. "Pardon me, madame, for recalling unpleasant memories, but I have a little idea." Poirot's little ideas were becoming a perfect byword, "and would like to ask one or two questions."
"Of me?"
"Certainly."
"You are too amiable, madame. What I want to ask is this. The door leading into Mrs. Inglethorpe's room from that of Mademoiselle Cynthia, it was bolted, you say?"
"Certainly it was bolted," replied Mary Cavendish, rather surprised. "I said so at the inquest."
"Bolted?"
"Yes." She looked perplexed.
"I mean," explained Poirot, "you are sure it was bolted and not merely locked?"
"Oh, I see what you mean. No, I don't know. I said bolted, meaning that it was fastened, and I could not open it. But I believe all the doors were found bolted on the inside."
"Still, as far as you are concerned, the door might equally well have been locked?"
"Oh, yes."
"You yourself did not happen to notice, madame, when you entered Mrs. Inglethorpe's room, whether that door was bolted or not?"
I believe it was."
"But you did not see it?"
"No, I never looked." "But I did," interrupted Lawrence suddenly. "I happened to notice that it was bolted."
"Ah, that settles it."
And Poirot looked crestfallen. I could not help rejoicing that, for once, one of his little ideas had come to naught. After lunch, Poirot begged me to accompany him home. I consented rather stiffly.
"You are annoyed, is it not so?"
he asked anxiously as we walked through the park. "Not at all," I said coldly.
"That is well. That lifts a great load from my mind." This was not quite what I had intended. I had hoped that he would have observed the stiffness of my manner. Still, the fervour of his words went towards the appeasing of my just displeasure. I thawed. "I gave Lawrence your message," I said.
"And what did he say? He was entirely puzzled?"
"Yes, I'm quite sure he had no idea of what you meant." I had expected Poirot to be disappointed, but to my surprise he replied that that was as he had thought, and that he was very glad. My pride forbade me to ask any questions. Poirot switched off on another tack.
"Mademoiselle Cynthia was not at lunch today. How was that?"
"She's at the hospital again. She resumed work today."
"Ah, she's an industrious little demoiselle, and pretty too. She's like pictures I have seen in Italy. I would rather like to see that dispensary of hers. Do you think she would show it to me?"
"I'm sure she would be delighted. It's an interesting little place."
"Does she go there every day?"
"She has all Wednesdays off and comes back to lunch on Saturdays. Those are her only times off."
"I will remember. Women are doing great work nowadays, and Mademoiselle Cynthia is clever. Oh, yes, she has brains, that little one."
"Yes, I believe she has passed quite a stiff exam."
"Without doubt. After all, it is very responsible work. I suppose they have very strong poisons there?"
"Yes, she showed them to us. They are kept locked up in a little cupboard. I believe they have to be very careful. They always take out the key before leaving the room."
"Indeed. It is near the window, this cupboard?"
"No, right the other side of the room."
"Why?"
Poirot shrugged his shoulders.
"I wondered, that is all. Will you come in?"
We had reached the cottage. "No, I think I'll be getting back. I shall go round the long way through the woods." The woods round Stiles were very beautiful. After the walk across the open park, it was pleasant to saunter lazily through the cool glades. There was hardly a breath of wind, the very chirp of the birds was faint and subdued. I strolled in a little way, and finally flung myself down at the foot of a grand old beech tree. My thoughts of mankind were kindly and charitable. I even forgave Poirot for his absurd secrecy. In fact, I was at peace with the world. Then I yawned. I thought about the crime, and it struck me as being very unreal and far off. I yawned again. Probably, I thought, it really never happened. Of course, it was all a bad dream. The truth of the matter was that it was Lawrence who had murdered Alfred Inglethorpe with a croquet mallet. But it was absurd of John to make such a fuss about it, and to go shouting out, "I tell you, I won't have it!" I woke up with a start. At once I realized that I was in a very awkward predicament. For about 12 feet away from me, John and Mary Cavendish were standing facing each other, and they were evidently quarrelling. And quite as evidently they were unaware of my vicinity, for before I could move or speak, John repeated the words which had aroused me from my dream. "I tell you, Mary, I won't have it." Mary's voice came, cool and liquid. "Have you any right to criticize my actions? It will be the talk of the village. My mother was only buried on Saturday, and here you are gadding about with the fellow." "Oh," she shrugged her shoulders, "if it is only village gossip that you mind." "But it isn't. I've had enough of the fellow hanging about. He's a Polish Jew, anyway."
"A tinge of Jewish blood is not a bad thing. It leavens the," she looked at him, "stolid stupidity of the ordinary Englishman."
Fire in her eyes, ice in her voice. I did not wonder that the blood rose to John's face in the crimson tide.
"Mary!"
"Well?" Her tone did not change. The pleading died out of his voice. "Am I to understand that you will continue to see Bauerstein against my express wishes?"
"If I choose."
"You defy me?"
"No, but I deny your right to criticize my actions. Have you no friends of whom I should disapprove?"
John fell back a pace. The colour ebbed slowly from his face. "What do you mean?" he said, in an unsteady voice.
"You see," said Mary quietly, "you do see, don't you, that you have no right to dictate to me as to the choice of my friends?"
John glanced at her pleadingly, a stricken look on his face.
"No right? Have I no right, Mary?" he said unsteadily. He stretched out his hands.
Mary?
For a moment I thought she wavered. A softer expression came over her face, then suddenly she turned almost fiercely away.
None.
She was walking away when John sprang after her and caught her by the arm.
Mary, his voice was very quiet now, are you in love with this fellow Bauerstein?
She hesitated, and suddenly there swept across her face a strange expression, old as the hills, yet with something eternally young about it. So might some Egyptian sphinx have smiled. She freed herself quietly from his arm and spoke over her shoulder.
Perhaps, she said,
and then swiftly passed out of the little glade, leaving John standing there as though he had been turned to stone. Rather ostentatiously I stepped forward, crackling some dead branches with my feet as I did so. John turned. Luckily, he took it for granted that I had only just come up on the scene. "Hello, Hastings. Have you seen the little fellow safely back to his cottage? Quaint little chap. Is he any good, though, really? He was considered one of the finest detectives of his day. Oh, well, I suppose there must be something in it, then. What a rotten world is it, though?"
"You find it so?" I asked.
"Good Lord, yes. There's this terrible business to start with. Scotland Yard men in and out of the house like a jack-in-the-box. Never know where they won't turn up next. Screaming headlines in every paper in the country. Damn all journalists, I say. Do you know there was a whole crowd staring in at the lodge gates this morning? Sort of Madame Tussaud's Chamber of Horrors business that can be seen for nothing. Pretty thick, isn't it?"
"Cheer up, John," I said soothingly. "It can't last forever."
"Can't it, though? It can last long enough for us never to be able to hold up our heads again."
"No, no, you're getting morbid on the subject."
"Enough to make a man morbid, to be stalked by beastly journalists and stared at by gaping moon-faced idiots, wherever he goes. But there's worse than that."
"What?"
John lowered his voice.
"Have you ever thought, Hastings, it's a nightmare to me. Who did it? I can't help feeling sometimes it must have been an accident. Because who could have done it? Now, Inglethorpe's out of the way. There's no one else. No one, I mean, except one of us."
"Yes, indeed. That was nightmare enough for any man. One of us? Yes, surely it must be so, unless..." A new idea suggested itself to my mind. Rapidly, I considered it. The light increased. Poirot's mysterious doings, his hints, they all fitted in. Fool that I was not to have thought of this possibility before, and what a relief for us all.
"No, John," I said, "it isn't one of us. How could it be?"
"I know, but still, who else is there?"
"Can't you guess?"
"No." I looked cautiously round and lowered my voice.
"Dr. Bauerstein," I whispered.